I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. I'm very pleased to have Robert J. Wiersma on now. I've long wanted to have him on as a guest, and I've long been reading his book reviews in sundry newspapers in this country. He's a prolific critic. Many times when I'll be researching an author guest for this show, invariably up comes his byline in the clippings files with a review of the book. He's an accomplished author himself, out with a new book, The World More Full of Weeping. It is a novella that sees 11-year-old Brian Page disappearing into the forest and embarking on a bit of a journey that contains all elements of a good story: secrets, fear, discovery, memory, and more. He is also a bookseller and events coordinator at Boland Books in Victoria, where he joins me from now. He also wrote the national bestseller and critically acclaimed Before I Wake. He's got another novel due out next year. I also hope to discuss fountain pens with him. The World More Full of Weeping is published by Chizine Publications. Did I say that right, Rob?
Chizine,
pardon me. His website for more is robertjwiersma.com. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Robert J. Wiersma. Good morning, Mr. Wiersma.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Brian, he's 11, right?
Yep.
Tell me about him.
He's, he's sort of the kid that I was at that age. I grew up in a town very much like the town Brian lives in, and he's a bit of a loner. He spends a lot of his time out in the woods behind his family's, it's not a working farm, but it used to be a farm, and he's enthralled with the natural world. He takes this battered old microscope with him in a wooden case, and he's always looking at samples, and he's got a guidebook that he takes with him. He's a geeky loner of a kid who's in love with the natural world.
You grew up in Agassiz?
I did.
And for people that don't know where that is, it's southwestern BC, right?
It is, about an hour and a half outside of Vancouver.
Yeah, and where Brian and his dad live, it's a town called Henderson?
It is.
It's also in southwestern BC, right?
It's also an hour and a half outside of Vancouver.
Why set it elsewhere? I know you have the essay in the back of the book, but people may be curious as to why you'd set it in a town other than where we would know.
Well, I think the essay does explain it better than I can out loud, but for me as a writer, it was important to create the town of Henderson as a proxy in many ways for Agassiz. There are a number of stories about Henderson. This is only the first one to come out. And the things that happen in that town and to that town, I could not do to the people of Agassiz. I could not do to the town that I grew up in. And yet I know that world. I know Agassiz intimately. But it's going to sound terrible to say, but like Joyce writing about Dublin, I can only write about it from a distance. I don't know Agassiz the way it is today. Henderson is in many ways what in my mind Agassiz would be if it was starting from the last point where I knew it intimately, which would be about 20 years ago now. So it's a proxy. It occupies the same physical space as the actual town of Agassiz, but it's turned a quarter turn to the weird to allow me the freedom that I need as a writer.
You grew up, you were born there?
Well, I was born in lovely downtown Chilliwack,
yeah.
As I think everyone who grew up in Agassiz was. But
right.
Yeah, I spent the first 17 years of my life there.
Well, growing up there, did you always think you would live your life out there, or did you think growing up that I'd be, I'm out of here when...
Yeah, honestly, it never occurred to me to live my life out there.
Do most of people, mostly, because I grew up in Vancouver, I was born and raised in Vancouver, and I still live here. I don't think I'd live anywhere else.
And I think for some people, Agassiz serves the same function. I don't have any criticism of it. I just it didn't offer me enough of the things that I needed. I needed a bigger world than the one that it offered. And I mean, Victoria doesn't quite offer enough either. In an ideal world, I'd be living in New York. I keep telling my wife and family that we're one movie deal away from living in New York.
Right. Yeah, I talked to Lorna Crozier about this. She grew up in Swift Current, Saskatchewan, and she says the same thing, that she had to get out. She knew she had to get out.
Yeah.
You get to New York a lot, don't you?
We try to go once a year.
Yeah.
And we just love it. My wife and I went the first time about 15 years ago, and we just fell in love. And we've been bringing our son since he was, since he was two was his first trip. But his first real immersive experience was when he was three, and that's when he started going to Broadway shows, and it's when he fell in love with the Metropolitan Museum and, you know, Soho and Greenwich Village, and it's just, it feels like home to us. It feels alive.
Now, Brian is 11. Your son, is he 11 too?
He's 10.
10. You told the Times columnist that you write out of fear.
Yep.
How much of that is true?
Well, as everything I say, it's completely true. it's not something I do consciously, or it's not something I did consciously. I'm realizing now, I'm recognizing when it starts to show up in my work. But yeah, I write out of fear. You can go all the way back, even before I wake. But certainly Before I Wake is the big example of that, because it's about a family in crisis when their 2.5-year-old daughter is hit by a car and is basically irreparably harmed, and they take her off life support. That was my fear. I wrote Before I Wake when my wife and I found out we were pregnant after years of trying. And I have a sort of, people call it negativity, but I have a glass half-empty view of the world. My first response to any change is fear. And the news that I was going to be a father, it brought out that what's the worst thing that could happen mindset. I started ruminating on that, and that's where Before I Wait came from. I wrote it in a 3-month blast of fear, because it was the worst thing that I could think of.
And so where's the fear that you feel in this book, The World More Full of Weeping?
Well, you can trace it up. I tend to anticipate my fear. With The World More Full of Weeping, it was written around the time that I was starting the new novel. And at that time, Xander would have been 6, just turning 7. And I was looking ahead 3 or 4 years to the moment when he would start pushing away and asserting his independence. And that's a tough time for a parent, because you need to encourage your child to be independent. You need for them to find their own path, literally, in Brian's case. But at the same time, you want to protect them as much as possible, because bad things do happen on the path. And that's the one of the themes of the new novel as well. So that I keep anticipating the fears that are to come, and I try to insulate myself against them through the work.
How much are you like the dad in the book?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. I think it depends on how you view the dad in the book. Easily distracted, a little bit distant. Yeah, I'll cop to both of those. But deeply attached and absolutely wrenched when bad things happen, I'll cop to that too.
How old were you when you wanted to know, when you knew you wanted to write?
7, 8.
Did you think that you could make a living out of it?
Well, I always hoped that I could. And frankly, I still hope that I can someday.
Yeah.
but I didn't see there being any other option for me. It was, it sounds trite to call something a calling, but that's the only way I can put it. And I fought that for a long time. I went to university and I got an English degree so that I could move on and go to grad school and eventually become a professor and write on the side while I had the security of tenure. But I couldn't do it. I eventually stopped fighting and just embraced what seemed to me to be a destiny.
You have this career as a bookseller.
Mm-hmm.
You've been in the business how long?
It'll be 20 years next year.
That must be a useful experience to you as a writer, is it?
It's an incredible experience for a writer. I would encourage anybody who's thinking of being a writer or is a writer to spend a couple of months working on the floor at a bookstore. I got into it when I was a student, and I was the cliched English student. I was absolutely insufferable and so sure of my tastes and so condescending to anything that I felt was beneath me. And then I started working in the bookstore, and I realized that, you know, there were other books than what I was reading in school, and people found value in stories. A book didn't need to be taken apart to be important. It just needed to speak to the readers. And working in a bookstore, I mean, to this very day, I'm thankful because I get to be in touch with that, with people. I get to see what they're actually reading, and I get to see what they're giving to people for gifts, and the difference between what they give people they don't really know, which are, you know, your prize-winning books or your popular books, and the gifts that they give people who they're intimate with, which are the books that touch them, the books that are important to them. And often, more times than not, those are two very different purchase patterns.
And the experience in the bookstore, does it matter what kind of store it is? Like if it's one of these big chains or one of these independent ones?
I'm indie to the core, but I think as far as the experience for a writer, I think you can find value in any bookstore, working in any bookstore. Because, I mean, readers are readers.
How often do you go to used bookstores?
Once a week.
Yeah.
Whenever I can make it downtown.
Yeah. I don't read fiction, but I'm always fascinated by fiction writers that I have on and learning about their habits as writers, because I don't write. And I think it's just, I mean, it's like looking at a painter and seeing someone create art. And I've been enjoying following your writing online on Facebook and Twitter. It's a marvelous insight into the process. As a writer, do you find that social network and the sort helps your writing?
It's like anything else, it's a double-edged sword. I've chosen to embrace it. When I was starting the new novel a couple of years ago, I had a really hard time with the voices. Ever since before Awake came out, I've been accessible. I've had the website. People can email me from it. I try to reply. I like the dialogue. I like hearing what people are thinking of my work. But it was a different writing experience for me, because Before I Wake was written completely in isolation, and there were no expectations whatsoever. The new novel was under contract. I knew what I was going to be writing. I knew I had it all mapped out. And at the same time, I was writing in public. I had something of a reputation. People were emailing me. There were reviews out there. And all of those voices in my head made it hard to find my footing for the new book. And eventually I just had to embrace it and to embrace the connections and to make the most of it, because I would have gone insane otherwise. The upside to that, of course, the difficulty in starting the new novel was that it resulted in the world more full of weeping and a book's worth of short stories. So there is an upside.
You mentioned in the book, in I don't know if it's in the acknowledgments of the essay at the back, I forget now, the RWF Yahoo board.
Yeah.
What is that?
It's a group. This is the bizarre nature of the world that we live in. It's a group of people who I connected with on Rec Music Artists Springsteen, which is a Usenet group for Springsteen fans. And word got out that I was a writer, and people started reading the book, and then somebody created this Yahoo group, which was essentially a fan group by invitation that was an offshoot of this Springsteen group. And I haven't met any of these people, even at this point, but they've proven to be very supportive. I think they read the first draft of The World More Full of Weeping back when it was called something else. I got their feedback on it. It was tremendous. It's not like a writer's group. They're not beta readers who will get into the nitty-gritty and really explore the use of the language. They're not writers in that way, but they're readers. And getting that sort of supportive focus group response has been really helpful. And it's just the most bizarre thing at the same time, because I don't know any of these people, but I feel very close to them.
So when do you write?
Every morning.
That's before you go to work, I guess, right?
Yeah, I get up at 4, well, the first alarm rings at 4. I'm generally out of bed before the third alarm goes at 4:20.
Yeah.
And I get up and I make a pot of coffee and I sit down and generally I fritter away 45 minutes or so, and then I get into the writing.
And the writing, once you get to it, that's longhand?
Yep.
Why longhand as opposed to the computer?
Well, I can address that question on two levels, but they're both related. For me, longhand allows me access to the story part of my head. It's a direct connection to the fiction part of my brain, and that's neurologically supported. The action of handwriting has been neurologically traced to a deeper connection with the creative parts of the brain. When I do reviews, when I'm writing reviews or writing pieces of journalism, I can't write them longhand. I have to write on the computer. It's a different part of the brain. The action of typing accesses a different part of the brain. And I'm fine with keeping those divisions. Every so often, I'm writing a short story now that I've got a short deadline on, and it would be easier in a lot of ways to just sit down on the computer and type it out. I can't bring myself to do it. I've tried writing short stories on the computer, and they don't feel right. The language doesn't feel right. It feels more disconnected. It feels more clinical. It feels more like a review. So I stick with the pens.
So when you're writing on paper with a pen, when does it go to a computer? Do you type that out yourself before you send it to an editor?
Yeah, it's completely illegible. I can barely read my own handwriting, so I can't farm it out to anyone else.
Yeah.
And the thing with the computer age is you don't have drafts anymore. It used to be that, you know, you would write a story and you would type it out and that'd be your first draft. And if you wanted to make any changes, you would have to retype it. So those changes and that process would constitute a second draft. With computers, you're really just looking at one continuous draft. So I use the transition from the written page to the printed page to constitute a shift between a first and a second draft. I'll make changes as I go in there, and then I'll print it off and I'll make some more changes and then I'll send it out for other people to look at.
I had Thomas Trofimuck on a few weeks ago.
Yep.
When he was in town for his book, and I read in the notes that he writes with a fountain pen. And so this began the last 6 weeks or so, this journey from the beginning of a relationship between me and a fountain pen. I went out and bought a cross pen, and then you and I had a discussion on this on Facebook.
Yeah, I revealed my full fountain pen wankery in
yeah.
that post.
Yeah, well, I found it highly instructive. And then about a week after, I used, it's a cross pen, and I don't know, it's made out of plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And it broke. The thing got screwed on, and I couldn't unscrew it and change the ink, etc. So I sent it in with a $6 check to the cross pen people, and I've been waiting, I think, about 5 or 6 weeks, and it just came this morning. So I'm you know, I've got my notes in front of me, and I'm making notes with my pen.
Uh-huh.
What kind of pen do you use?
I'm all over the map. Currently, I'm carrying a Lamy fountain pen and a Pelican. So two good German fountain pens.
Yeah, and why for you fountain pens as opposed to like a ballpoint? I'm a big fan of rollerballs, and I use the Parker rollerballs.
Yeah, I've played with rollerballs. Part of it's just affectation, of course.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody picks up a fountain pen without thinking, oh, this is cool.
Right. Right.
But I like the way they feel in my hand. I like the way the words come out. I adore the process of writing. And one of the things that I like about it is just how sensual it is. Like the feeling of actually putting ink down on paper. The way a good nib will just skate over the surface of the paper and leave behind the traces of the words. It's a beautiful thing to me.
And have you tried writing with, say, a pencil or something else other than a fountain pen?
I've used rollerballs. I've used gel pens, and I've used the sort of fiber art pens. Those are quite fun. But I think I like them because they're the closest you get to a to a fountain pen without being a fountain pen.
The book reviewing, when did that start for you?
About 10 years ago now.
And as I suspect that reading inspires the writer in you. Does reviewing make you a better writer?
I think so. I think it's made me a better writer. It certainly made me a more aware writer. Because I decided when I first started reviewing and I realized that I was going to be hosting people at the store whose books I had reviewed, and I had to make a decision at that point if I was going to keep reviewing, if I was going to, or if I was going to wimp out and start just, you know, sucking up. And at that point, I sort of made a stand that no, I was gonna be honest in the reviews, and I would take the consequences whenever I needed to. And as a result of that, I've written some negative reviews and some fairly high-profile negative reviews. And there have been incidents, but what that meant was when Before I Wake was in process and we were doing editorial work, I realized that it couldn't just be good enough. I couldn't possibly put out a book that flatlined in the last third when I had spent the past several years commenting on so many books, so many first novels especially, that flatlined in the last third. I couldn't do it. So it made me very aware of my own work. But it also makes me very... it's a circle. The reviewing informs the writing, and the writing informs the reviewing, because I make a point of approaching a work on its own merits. I don't think there's any justification in reviewing Dan Brown the same way you would Cormac McCarthy. There's no point to it. So each work has to be examined on the terms that it sets out for itself. And I think as a writer, I have an easier time determining what those terms are, because I know it from my own work. I know what you set up and how you set things up. And as a result, you can determine as a critic whether a book works or if it doesn't, according to the goals it sets out for itself.
Sean Cranberry has started with, I forget the woman's name, Julie Wilson, I think is her name, this Advent book blog, and you've already recommended a book or two, as I understand, right?
Yep.
He's asked me to do that, and the two books that, I've thought of three books that I really like this year, two of which you reviewed and you really liked, the Michael Chabon book and Waste and Choice book.
Yep.
When you, what are the books that you recommended?
I recommended the Absolute edition of Alan Moore's Z for Vendetta, which is a graphic novel from the 1980s.
Yeah. These two books that I'm recommending. I mean, when I had them on, each time, you know, you collect the sheaf of reviews and the sort, and your reviews were there. You like both books?
I did.
Yeah. The Waste and Choi book, I mean, I still remember your line in there that he's one of Canada's most beloved writers.
Yeah, he really is. He's, he's a nice guy.
Yeah.
When you meet him in person, he's a genuinely nice guy. But he's a genuine person, and that comes through in his books. And he's got a big heart, and that comes through. He's one of the good ones.
Mm-hmm. The next novel that comes out next year.
Mm-hmm. All going well.
Yeah, and I think the Times columnist asked you about it. You didn't want to say anything about it.
I'm a little superstitious.
Yeah.
It's about fathers and sons, and it's about a book that a father gives his son for his 11th birthday. And the book takes his son into a different world. And it's about a father trying to rescue a son and about a son trying to grow up enough to save himself.
Has your own son read your books?
No, not yet.
Not even this one?
No, not this one.
Yeah.
He's not quite there yet.
Yeah.
Although the next one I did, I promised him in Before I Wake that in the acknowledgments to Before I Wake that the next one would have hamsters and there would be people heroically jumping off cliffs. And I fulfilled my part of the bargain.
There you go. Rob, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. As I said, I've long wanted to have you on the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Continued good luck with this book.
Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. The website for more is robertjweersma.com. The book is called The World More Full of Weeping. It's Chizine Publications, or Chizine.
Chizine.
I screwed that up so badly.
I don't think they've actually decided.
They haven't decided? Okay. Well, then I'm safe then. Robert Wiersma on the line. From Victoria in Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.